Across ABC Radio, this is Serene Damaki.
The pandemic's seen many of us get in touch with our natural world, or should I say, more in touch with our natural world. Bushwalking, tending to gardens, and appreciating nature. And for many, especially those working from home, time to notice the birds. Bird watching, bird song. I know I've been paying more attention to the chirps and trills of the birds around my neighbourhood, and the feeling is one of peace, tranquility. I think that kind of sets the mood. Mona Arshi is a UK-based poet who was formerly a human rights lawyer. Her debut collection, Small Hands, won the Forward Prize for Best First Collection in 2015. Her poems and interviews have been published in The Times, The Guardian, Granta and The Times of India, as well as on the London Underground. During the severe UK lockdown, she found herself intensely listening to birdsong. And she found that it brought to her forgotten words from her childhood in her mother tongue, Punjabi. It inspired Mona to more poetry, to somehow transcribe what she was hearing from the calls of lapwings, reed warblers and redshanks around her. And she joins us now from the UK. Mona, welcome to Weekend Evenings.
Serene, thank you so much for having me. I'm so delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. And where do we find you this morning? It's about 10 a.m. in Britain, right? Are you hearing the morning song of birds where you are?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not. I'm hearing the sound of rain.
Oh, no!
Yeah, in a wonderful UK fashion. We've had 6 days of really intense sunshine. And then this morning, it just started raining. I heard it in the middle of the night. I could hear the rain, you know, that lovely feeling. And you just feel it was all, everything is fresh again. So
yes.
Sadly, no birdsong this morning.
Well, you made an interesting career transition a decade ago, Mona, from law to poetry, something I think many lawyers would like to do. What inspired it from human rights lawyer to poet? How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a question I've been asked a lot because it is unusual. Mm. And I kind of want to say that there are things in common, but to be honest with you, it's such a radical shift.
Sea change?
It's a very good word, sea change. So But I've always really needed poetry. So, I mean, I worked in a human rights setting. I was dealing with very difficult cases involving dignity cases, lots of quite difficult cases involving victims and families. Yeah. And I've always used poetry. I mean, I felt like I've always needed it. And then
like an outlet?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't write it. I just
read it.
Used it, you know, read it. Yeah. And then I stopped reading it, I think. And then I had my daughters, my twins. And then whilst I had time to sort of stop, I started going back to reading it and then suddenly discovering it, rediscovering it and re-encountering it, actually, and just realizing that I was getting so much. I was getting a real hit out of the, of the work. And I started writing it.
Did you read poetry to your girls? I don't know why that just popped into my head. Obviously, we think of bedtime story time. Was bedtime story for you? Bedtime story time. If that was something you did with your girls, was poetry involved? You've made me think.
Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
Absolutely. I mean, actually, poetry is very much part of our body. We are born. I think children are born to write poetry. There's something about the meter of poetry and the heartbeat, the rhythm. So I think that we're really wired for poetry. I think what happens is that we start living a world which is, you know, busy, and then we become sort of slightly less disconnected from it because we stop hearing, I guess. And I guess that's why I think the bird project was quite interesting, because it was a kind almost a childlike activity, you know.
Yeah.
A very primal thing of just like listening to something really closely and paying attention to it.
Well, it's an interesting observation, and you've just in these moments have made me think about bedtime story with my 7-year-old, because books that she really enjoys and she points out deliberately is that, Mummy, that's a rhyming book. That's a book that rhymes. And I haven't sat and read poetry. I'm going to start doing this. I am going to do this, Mona. It's so in because it's a very different way of coming at literature with children. And I don't know. I wonder if it's something that is common. I know I'm digressing a little bit from where we want to head in our conversation. I want to get to it. But that is something that, is quite profound when we think about I think about poetry for grown-ups. I came into poetry at a much older age. It wasn't very much so part of my childhood. So it's wonderful hearing how that's a part of your world with your girls.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it makes you think about language in a different way, and it also, you know, prose can be very musical, and I think just being able to listen to sound and rhythm and a sort of shift in syntax even, I think just makes you more alert to reading and just language generally.
So birds, were birds and an interest in birds part of your childhood at all?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
No. I mean, it wasn't something that, I mean, this is why it was so interesting, because I literally was I've always lived, and I still live, very near Heathrow Airport, which is a strange thing. So, I mean, you know, probably the first sound I ever heard wasn't birds. It was probably a Boeing because, you know, they were coming across our house every, 3.5 minutes.
And they do sound pretty awesome.
they do. But so two things happened at the same time this year. I had suddenly we were in lockdown. And so you could hear things, that there were hardly any planes in the sky. And suddenly you could just hear everything. You could hear we have many, many parrots where we are for some reason. And so you could hear them sort of, chirping in the trees. And you could just hear birdsong for the first time in my parents' garden, which is, which is very close to Heathrow. So that happened. And then at the same time, I became poet in residence in a beautiful space in Clye Marshes in Norfolk, which is a bird sanctuary. And my job was to go there and to make poetry. And so the two things sort of happened at the same time, actually. And I was really, I'm not a birder. I don't know the names of birds. For me, it's a really different, quite, alienating space, actually, countryside. It's not something that I'm familiar with at all, British countryside. But suddenly I was put there. And what I discovered actually was quite magical, which is that if you just allow yourself in those spaces and you listen carefully and you just sort of sink in to the atmosphere and listen, it arouses all sorts of different things in your body. And one of those things was my childhood language, which I never ever use, Punjabi. It's not a public language. I've never written in it. It's sort of, I call it my back of my body language. It's like a language I might have used in my childhood with my parents, and then I sort of left it behind. And then there it was, suddenly it was sort of really at the fore. Very surprising discovery.
Tell us then more about the birds you were studying, observing, hearing, and these words that you heard through the bird's song.
Yeah. So first of all, what I did was I couldn't go to Clye initially, by the way. It was very difficult to get there because of the pandemic, and we were under lockdown, so I couldn't go there. So I had to do the next best thing, which was to go and find the recordings of the birds that were situated in Clye online. And actually that was a real gift, actually, because it meant that I could I was just really interested in it. I just wanted to slow down a reed warbler. Mm-hmm. And I found, if you slow down a reed warbler 50%, it sounds like a fox.
Really?
And if you slow it, yes. Yeah. And if you slow it down even further, it sounds like a dinosaur. It's so strange. And so it was really, so I kind of just got into really listening to the granularity of the song. I mean, some songs, some birds are really difficult to listen to. The geese are really, and there's loads of pink-footed geese in Clyne, and they were impossible to listen to and to transcribe. But I did realise that there are some birds like the lapwings and the warblers that were, I could actually hear if I was, you know, if I was attentive enough, I could actually hear the kind of the words. And actually what's interesting is, of course, that I think one of the reasons why your ear responds in a sort of different way with birdsong is that, of course, there is no grammar or syntax. Mm. You know, there are just sounds, abstract sounds. So because you don't have syntax, you're not trying to make sense of it. I mean, actually, the point is not to make sense. The point is birdsong is just there. So you are trying to just not make sense of it or have a conversation even with you know what's going on. That's impossible. What you're trying to do is just to literally transcribe what is there. And I think that does something very different to the imagination.
How so?
It kind of gives you all these possibilities to think about, you know, where the poetry might go. Mm. So, you know, it seeds all these things. You know, there was a wonderful poet, actually, Joy Harjo, who's a US poet, who said, even placelessness is a place. And I love that. That became a sort of a bit of a mantra for me. You know, this idea of here I was in a space I didn't really know, and listening to birds I didn't really know, who were saying things that I didn't really understand. And yet there was this possibility of making something, you know, quite unusual from what was there, like almost like a sort of tapestry, you know,
yes.
Sort of knitting, almost like knitting poetry. So it sounds really eccentric and mad, but I think sometimes those spaces are the spaces where the kind of most interesting work can flourish, in those sorts of kind of liminal spaces, if you know what I mean.
Yes. And what words did you hear from the lapwing or the reed warbler that was in your mother tongue or your back, what did you call it? Your backbone.
Back of my body.
Back of your body language.
Yeah. I mean, there were lots, but I suppose there was one particular
There were
word.
Lots, were there?
Yeah, yeah. So there was this, there's the lapwing, for example. The lapwing's call is kiwi, wee wee, which kiwi means kiu, means why in Punjabi.
Right.
And it was so weird. I kept hearing them say this. And then there were other words as well, like that the reed warbler would say this thing called, it sounds like torade, which means give me a little. And that was very distinctive. And once I heard it, I actually checked with my mother.
Well, that's just it. That's what's fascinating, is that this is a language that has fallen asleep in you. It's lay dormant. So I can understand, I guess, being bilingual, you know, sometimes you hear something, I was like, oh, that sounds like, the bird sounds like it's saying this word in English or that word in Arabic, for me, if it was bilingual, for example. But this was a language for you that was dormant. And one that you weren't using. So to arouse that, to ignite that and reignite that and bring that to the fore and the surface is, that's pretty fascinating, Mona. So you checked with your mum.
Yeah, and she said, no, that's absolutely right. You have heard right. And she was fascinated as well. Mm. So I realised that there was something going on that I think was interesting. And actually the other thing is, I think, which is important to say, is that, I mean, I'm from the diaspora. You know, my parents came to the UK in the 1970s. I was born in the UK and they came from the countryside, and yet they settled in urban spaces, which is very, very common for the diaspora, you know, from those from the diaspora. But then they didn't go into the countryside, you know. So I think that's really sad that they didn't. And there was lots of reasons for that. They felt quite estranged. Mm. I think when they had been into the countryside, there had been, you know, some encounters that weren't very pleasant. You know, they didn't feel like it was their countryside. And there was a sort of real sadness in that. But then I just felt this huge amount of elation and joy that their daughter was now in the countryside, you know, and feeling quite connected to a space.
And bringing this to them.
And I, so I sort of felt like it was important. And I do think that if we're in these spaces, it's really important to have different writers from different backgrounds in these spaces, because what we do is we can bring a fresh perspective. And I think this is really important. It's a different way of looking at something, and almost like picking up something and just thinking, actually, this is the way I'm looking at it, and then passing it on to somebody else who might not have seen it like that. Because poems are like portals, you know, you can pass on these parts of the imagination to somebody else through this little kind of window, which is the poem. So I think that's really important. And I particularly think that for children, because, you know, you could take one child to this space and say, listen, what do you hear? But then if you have another a mother tongue, you might hear something completely different. And I think that's worth listening to.
Yes. And it's subjective in that way.
Yeah, it is subjective, which is a wonderful thing, you know, about these complexities of language and hearing.
If you've just joined us, you're with me, Serene Damaki, on ABC Radio's National Weekend Evenings, and I am speaking with human rights lawyer turned poet Mona Arshi. We are talking about poetry. We're talking about birdsong and birdsong's connection for Mona to linguistics, to her mother tongue. So did this, Mona, wake up your back bodies? I've forgotten it already. Back bodies language? No. That doesn't sound right.
Back of my body language. Yeah.
For you, so did this also bring you back to wanting to speak your mother tongue again?
A little bit. I mean, I guess it's a language I think that I love. I mean, the Punjabi it sounds so beautiful. But I feel as if it's really difficult to go back to a language that you haven't used. And I think that there's a sort of sadness in that as well, that I haven't used it enough, you know, that I probably am feeling slightly from re-encountering it. But it's something that I feel as if we should value. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you, it's not a language when I was at school that was valued. You know, we were told to not speak those languages. We were told to speak English. It was the dominant language that was kind of instilled into us at the time. Things are changing now. You know, those languages are valued and their literatures are valued. But it wasn't the same sort of culture then, I think.
Mm. But perhaps for you, that loss of language has been reclaimed in another way through this experience in CLI and transcribing that and bringing that out in your poetry, which I want to hear more about. Tell us about your poetry and transcribing your findings, for want of a better way to describe it. You wrote a piece on the Future Informed website, and in it you mentioned that transcribing bird songs, an activity that has fallen out of fashion.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that. What's it like? What was it like? What's it like now?
Well, there's been a long tradition of writing, of transcribing birdsong. I mean, poets, the Romantics, John Clare, very famously, wrote into nature and, you know, and wrote, actually translated poems from the natural world. But I think just because we live in such a technological age, so people have started doing other things of, you know, actually going in with and actually sort of trying to sort of think about birdsong in slightly different ways. And so they bring sonographs and all sorts of ways, you know, we've had this sort of digitalized experience of birdsong. And that's one way, which is quite interesting. But I just think there is the simple activity of actually going in and just saying with your notebook and just thinking about what you hear. That, I think, has fallen out of fashion.
Mm.
And
like I penmanship.
Think that... Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a strong believer in going in with writing in pen and not going straight
computer.
To your laptop anyway. Just because I think there's a real relationship between your the eye, the ear, and then your hand, and so just going in and just literally just being immersing yourself. I mean, if anything, this is an immersive activity. And it does slow down time, by the way. It really does. you just sit with it. And that's quite radical, because in this kind of busy, kind of overloaded,
absolutely.
days, do we actually have that time to just to immerse ourselves into something really simple? We're not trying to find an answer. There's no certainty. It's just literally just sitting with it.
Mm. Tell us about the Future Informs Shifting Lines project. So tech is involved in it too, is that right?
Yeah. Mm. So this is a really innovative project that the University of East Anglia, where I studied, so I'm an alumni from that university, basically commissioned six writers to go into the sort of the landscape and to actually work with digital companies and to sort of work out how to write projects that were actually going to be in a digital space. So for me, I worked with a brilliant company called Mutiny, and they and I sat down and worked out how we could elevate these poems and then bring them into an installation and somehow create sort of digital envelopes in these space as well. So when you walk around Clyde, the Berg Sanctuary, you can go to sort of different points, and then you could have your phone and your headphones in, and you can hit a little part of your phone, and that'll open up a sort of digital envelope, which will be the poem, and that will be where I wrote the poem, for example.
Right.
So I wrote a poem on the North Sea, and you can hear that poem, and then there's a little hide where you can sort of maybe where I wrote a poem about the lapwing, and then you can hear that poem. So that, but what was really important, and I think that what I've learned, this is the first time I've ever worked with technology, and I was really worried because poems can be very delicate, and I didn't want them to be overwhelmed with the digital technology. So there was a real sensitivity to how we were going to do this. But actually, it was amazing, because what we've ended up doing is having really something that is a very much a listening project. And we managed to braid the poems into the kind of the natural world and actually sort of turn them into something that are kind of like almost like hybrid forms, you know. So you hear the poem, and then on top of that you hear the music of Cly, you know, that we've extracted. So you hear the geese maybe overlain with it, or you hear the reeds, the Norfolk reeds, which are really part of the kind of chorus of the place almost, you know. That they have this kind of, they're constantly there, and you hear them kind of, you know, in your ear, you know, as you walk around, and they sound different wherever you are. And so you hear, and then you hear the North Sea as you walk towards the sea. And so the sea is very much part of the landscape. So those are also overlain over the poems as well. And you can find that on the website, the Shifting Lines website. So doing that was really, really interesting. And it was just a real opportunity for a poet to go into the digital space in a really innovative way.
Well, that's kind of cool, isn't it? Because isn't that what we do when we travel and visit historical sites or people and notable people from our history? We go, we stand somewhere, the Colosseum in Italy, for example, and we stand there and we say, this is where such and such performed, you know, races or the gladiators, and then we go and we go to another part of the world and stand in a space and remember a moment in time in our history, even on, from a personal level, even when it just comes to family or friends or people that have come in and out of our lives that have made an impression, we'll go and visit somewhere that is part of that, and we'll stand there and just be in that space. Hearing you talk about this project and what you've done with this project, and thinking about how you didn't want technology to, the delicacy when it comes to poems and how you've used it, has made me think of that.
I also think that the space that I'm writing into, Cly, is you know, it won't be around in 40 years time. You know, it's suffering the effects of climate change. It's diminishing slowly. It won't be there in 40 years time. And there was a real there's a real sort of, you know, when you write into that space, there is a real sensitivity and truth. You have to sort of tell the truth of the situation, which is that this is a space that won't be around. So I felt like it was a real privilege to write into this sort of almost like this legacy project, to leave something behind, you know, which is like, I think what we've done is actually we've tried to reflect the soul of Cly into these works. We've tried to really think about, you know, not sort of writing into with Cly as opposed to for Cly, you know, sort of, so being so sensitive to what's there, not interfering with anything, not touching anything, just sensitively sort of almost like having our antennae and picking up what's there, reading it, and then transcribing it into these poems, and hopefully, you know, later generations can enjoy it too.
Yes. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed reading your poems on your website. They're quite beautiful. And I would probably to say Ghazal is probably one that I really enjoyed. It reminded me a little of something from my culture and language and the eyes of the Ghazal. Mm. And my mum would always refer to that when she saw someone that she thought had beautiful eyes. So that's how that came across for me, if we're talking about when we're, you know, if I think about what we're talking about earlier when it comes to it being so subjective. So, Mona, would you be so kind as to leave us with a reading of Ghazal?
Yes. So I have two ghazals. Actually, I have several, but I thought the one that I might read, if that's okay, is the one which has got a little bird epigraph.
Totally.
Which is because it seemed apt. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for having me on. I've enjoyed our conversation so much.
Oh, and as have I. And so does about the 3-minute mark sound okay for you in terms of your poem and timing? Does that work? Yep. Excellent.
Yeah, that works.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Take it away, Mona, please.
Thank you. Ghazal. I thought you my bird and built you a nest in my heart. Arab saying. Breathe me in this disheveled night, I go unnoticed. The airs turn strange and solid, but only I will notice. If I allow beams of light to pass through the pinholes of my torso, and if light strikes the wall on the other side, would you notice? Tonight you're 3 parts God and 1 part sandalwood dust. I keep catching your scent by the window. I always notice. My words pile up like prophets on the point of my tongue. What passes for transparency are those things you don't notice. I steal robin's eggs and sketch powder down feathers for you. My pocket heats a pulsing nest. The creatures never even notice. If you could let me bangle my arms around you, rain would fall. It would speck my lips, my open fingers. Then you'd notice. Instead, my eye remains locked in the platinum part of the flower. The highest branches are the only living things to notice.
Mona, thank you. And I have to agree with how you describe the feeling of reading poetry as something about your atoms shifting when you read something.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us on Weekend Evenings. Have a wonderful rest of a Friday and weekend as well. Thanks so much, Mona. And I hope it's not too wet.
Thanks very much, Spreen. Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Mona Arshi, their human rights lawyer turned poet.
Serene Damaki on Weekend Evenings.